From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, assisted suicide, from the perspective of someone who's faced the ethical dilemmas as a doctor, friend, and son. We'll talk with Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, author of the new book, A Chosen Death. Also today, on the waterfront, with former longshoreman Reg Theriault. He spent over 30 years on the piers of San Francisco and was the vice president of his union's local. He's written a new book about the working person's life called How to Tell When You're Tired. And rock historian Ed Ward pays tribute to the music of R&B singer Mabel John. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal Reserve policymakers have decided to leave interest rates where they are. The central bankers met in Washington, D.C. today. They've issued a statement saying only that their meeting has ended. There was no announcement of a rate change. The last time the policymakers met, they moved to ease short-term interest rates a quarter of a point. The key federal funds rate will stay at 5.75%. A few analysts are suggesting the Federal Reserve could act to ease interest rates one more time by the end of the year. Republican Senator Richard Lugar is chairing a Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee hearing on the effects of nuclear material smuggled out of Russia. His panel will also examine the threat of nuclear terrorism and actions the West could take to prevent disaster. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Jamestown Foundation Research Director Paul Goebel told the Senate panel that among Russian reformers, the Army's woes are seen as the price of demilitarizing Russian society, and its political clout is pre-staging a Brezhnev-era kind of authoritarianism. Goebel says the Russian Army's obvious weaknesses are sparking behavior by some of Russia's neighbors that only exacerbates their relations with Moscow.
Its current or political strength is leading many to seek protection from the West via NATO or some other mechanism, or to decide that they must quickly make the best deal they can with Moscow before the army retakes power.
In dealing with the threat of nuclear terrorism, Goebel says the West must avoid the one-sided approach of believing either there is nothing to worry about or that there is nothing the West can do. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
A decision on whether jurors will hear potentially explosive taped conversations with a key police witness in the O.J. Simpson murder trial has been delayed until next week. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne has this report.
The judge announced in court today that it would take him about a week to review the tapes and weigh their admissibility. Attorney Johnny Cochran said out of court today that the defense had gotten yet another tape from conversations that film teacher Laura Hart McKinney had with Detective Mark Furman for a screenwriting project. While waiting for the decision on the tapes, the defense has returned to the subject of O.J. Simpson's demeanor just before the murders. To that end, the defense put on the stand a friend of both Simpsons, Christian Reichardt. Reichardt testified that Simpson had been jovial and relaxed on the day of the murders. Under cross-examination, Reichardt conceded, however, that Simpson had been depressed in the weeks leading up to the crime, upset that Nicole Simpson kept changing her mind about whether she wanted to get back together or not. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
Investigators have recovered the flight recorders from the wreckage of a commuter plane crash. That happened yesterday in West Georgia. A spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board says both recorders have been sent for testing. Five people died in yesterday's crash. Another 24 people were hurt. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 4.5 points at 4,610. This is NPR. Students attending the Virginia Women's Institute for Leadership program arrived today at Mary Baldwin College. This is the court-approved alternative to admitting women to Virginia Military Institute. Jay O'Neill of member station WVTF reports.
Virginia Military Institute has welcomed its 156th freshman class, and there are no women. School spokesman Mike Strickler says 422 newcomers showed up for Rat Week, while the Lexington, Virginia Institute remains under a legal cloud regarding its male-only admissions policy.
The Justice Department has petitioned the United States Supreme Court to review the case and reverse the decision of a lower court.
That decision allowed an alternative military program for women to be set up at the nearby Mary Baldwin College. The U.S. Supreme Court has yet to indicate whether it will hear the VMI Mary Baldwin case. For National Public Radio, I'm Jay O'Neill reporting.
Zaire is continuing to force Rwandan refugees back to their homeland. A United Nations official says Zairean soldiers are driving some 11,000 refugees back into Rwanda. As many as 60,000 other refugees are running into the hills. Many don't have any food or safe drinking water. The Zairean government hasn't explained its actions, but relief agencies say the expulsions are intended to pressure the UN to find another country to take the refugees. The UN is still trying to pull peacekeepers out of the safe area of Garajda. Bosnian Serbs are shelling the town. They've prevented peacekeepers from leaving because they want to make sure the peacekeepers' weapons won't be left behind for city defenders. Western allies have promised before they'll protect Garajda, the last Muslim enclave in eastern Bosnia. But the UN says shelling over the weekend that killed three girls doesn't count. The Associated Press is quoting a Western diplomat who says the UN isn't responding because it wants to pull out its peacekeepers safely. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Jack Kevorkian was with Esther Cohen when she committed suicide yesterday. The 46-year-old woman left a note saying that as a result of multiple sclerosis, she felt reduced to the status of a bedridden vegetable. Officials ruled the death a homicide. My guest, Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, has wrestled with the question of assisted suicide as a son, as a friend, and as a doctor. He's hardly alone. He says in darkened bedrooms across the country, thousands of parents, children, husbands, wives, lovers, and friends are deciding whether or not to aid in the death of a loved one. Dr. Shavelson is an emergency room physician who has written a new book called A Chosen Death. It tells the stories of several individuals who were forced to confront their own dilemmas about death and suicide. Dr. Shavelson first faced the question of assisted suicide when he was 14, and his mother was chronically ill and severely depressed. She told him that if her condition worsened, she wanted him to give her a fatal intravenous injection of potassium chloride. That request was a horrible burden.
Well, it's a horrible burden for anyone, and I think that what it taught me, and it began the beginning of this project later in my life as a journalist, of looking into what this is about, because since it's presently illegal for families or for patients to go to physicians and ask for assistance in death, and there are so many people who are really worried and concerned about suffering at the end of their life, this has really now been turned back to the families, and what I wanted to do was to explore this whole issue of what happens in families when somebody asks for help of another family member. In their own death. And it's something that I had experienced as a child, and I really realized that this is the story of Jack Kevorkian is really the tip of the iceberg of what we're seeing. There are thousands of families that are personally experiencing this every day, and I wondered what that was like for other people, as it had been for me.
Did it ever come close with your mother? Did she ever say, this is the time, you have to help me now?
No, it kept on getting put off. I think when I was 14, she had actually said to me, this is the time, you have to help me now. And after that point in time, it became something that fell into the background and waxed and waned with her disease. And to me is a good lesson now in looking at this issue more closely about the role that depression can play, because I think at the times that when my mother was most depressed was when the times when she was most close to saying, this is the time, help me now. And I think that obviously as we look at this issue of when somebody would be assisted in a suicide with a terminal illness, a true terminal illness, is that the role of depression has to be something that's understood very, very well before somebody does even think about assisting.
Your father had a heart attack years later. Did he ever come close to asking you to help him terminate his life?
No, not a chance with my dad. I think this was the most profound lesson for me in terms of individual needs and desires and how we have to respond to those. My father was actually in an intensive care unit at a time when his heart stopped and he was having difficulty breathing and suffering greatly, actually, for a period of about 24 hours. And I was by his side during that entire time watching his suffering and watching him say only repeatedly, don't let me die. He would do anything to live on for another extra minute through whatever suffering it took to get that extra minute. Whereas I think the lesson for my mother was that for her personal decision is if the suffering became too great that she would rather not live. And it really is an important thing to understand that these are really significant individual choices and not something that can be put on someone from the outside.
Why did you decide to talk with other people about their choices in how to end their life?
Well, I really thought that this is a story that is not being understood very well, and we're talking about a sort of theoretical issue, or at least what seems like a theoretical issue, of someday legalizing the physician's ability to assist in a suicide of a patient with a terminal illness who is suffering. And I, you know, I saw the news about Jack Kevorkian and all the sort of screaming headlines about Dr. Death, and also knew that Final Exit, a book of recipes for suicide, had sold now up to 640,000 copies in this country, so that there were literally over 500,000 people thinking about this issue of how they can end, avoid suffering at the end of life. What I realized was that the stories about Jack Kevorkian were the stories that were making the headlines, that underneath all of this there was a tremendously large hidden underground of families that in secrecy had to deal with this. And it was my desire to understand that better and to make the public understand better. If we're making a decision about whether we want to legalize this, let's see how it's working in today's real world. And what I wanted to do was introduce the reader to the real world of personal issues with real people who are dealing with this issue.
One of the women who you spoke with for your book was named Renee. She had brain cancer.
Mm-hmm.
At what point in her illness did she start thinking about the possibility of suicide?
Well, actually, with Renee Somm, it wasn't just an interview that I did, nor with any of the other people in the book. I actually spent close to 2 years with Renee Somm watching her first, and this is the most important thing. Renee was someone who believed in her right if she was suffering too much at the end of life. She was a woman who had a cancer in her brain. And she really believed that if she became hallucinatory or she became in a lot of pain or there was an anguishing part of her death, that it was her right to have assistance or to take her own life. But at the same time, Renee was the most intense fighter to stay alive. And I watched her through two neurosurgical procedures, trying to shrink the tumor down. I watched her fight her way into an experimental program in Sweden where she had a slicing beam of radiation with something called a gamma knife. And Renee bought 5 extra years from the time of her diagnosis. Immediately for me, dispelling the myth that somebody might, you know, if assistance in suicide at the end of life were legalized, that someone would say, oh, I have cancer, give me the shot and quit. No one that I saw in interviewing for this book was somebody who stopped their treatment or who just decided to lay down and die. This was really a decision in the last 24 to 48 hours when all hope was really lost. And I spent 2 years with Renee talking about why she might want to do that, what were the circumstances, and learned also that nobody can predict until the moment comes how are you going to feel at the moment of death. And that was a repeated lesson. I worked with actually 12 families during the entire project of this book. And the repeated lesson was that you can say how you want to die, you can say you think you understand it, but it always happens in a different way, and it always is a decision that has to be made at the time, not in advance.
Was there a difference for Renee between the point when she thought she would want to take her life and the point when she actually decided to take her life?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think Renee, when it was clear to everyone that she was down to 70 pounds, she was having severe headaches, she was having a lot of hallucinations because of the brain tumor, and it was very, very clear that she was very, very close to death. Renee, of course, at that time, having been through so many fights to stay alive, kept on insisting, maybe there's something more we can do. We have to try another treatment. We have to do this. And it wasn't until a remarkably lucid moment, actually, probably within a day of her death, that she finally said, enough, I really can't do this anymore. It's time to go.
You're a doctor. Did she ask you for your advice on how she should go?
She actually did. At the time, what had happened with Renee, which was, again, another profound lesson, was that in spite of all of the talking we had done over the couple of years that we worked together, she had never really gotten it together with getting the medications that she needed, with understanding what the process would be. Actually, for somebody who's weak and debilitated as Renee was, the process of taking your own life is a tremendously difficult thing to do. And Renee had always thought this was some theory that she might need to do in the future and had never really made the preparations. As such, she asked me in the end, how can I do this? Because she was finally ready and accepting of the fact that she just couldn't go on in the condition she was for another 24 to 48 hours. She was suffering too much. It happened that she had been prescribed a large dose of morphine by her physician for pain and that she had enough for literally 12 times the lethal dose of morphine at her bedside.
Were you with her when she took the morphine?
I was.
How did you end up being with her? Had she asked for you to stay?
She did. She asked. She did not want to be alone at the time that she was dying, and she asked for me to stay.
She took the morphine. She was unconscious. You were at her bedside. Actually, you were there for hours.
Yes. She took the morphine at 8 p.m. and very rapidly after taking that larger dose of morphine and with some alcohol as well in order to alcohol enhances the lethal effect of that overdose of morphine. And Renee was very, very much at that point in time ready to die. She had finally really reached the point where she had made up her mind and knew what she wanted to do. At 8 o'clock, she took the overdose of morphine, and I sat by the bedside for the entire night watching as her breathing slowed. I could still see her pulse. She was very thin. You could see above her collarbone. You could still see her pulse flickering. And it went on and on and on until 6 o'clock in the morning, and my own torture was tremendous during that time as well. And at 6 in the morning, when the sun came up, it felt like some spell had been broken. We had been in her darkened room in secrecy. Her friends were the only people who knew that this was happening. It had to be hidden from the hospice team and from her physicians, who would have immediately stopped the process because of its illegality. At that point in time, when the sun came up, it felt like the magical hidden world had been broken. And suddenly I realized, well, the hospice team was going to arrive for the morning visit. Renee had been breathing so shallowly that she had sustained further brain damage but hadn't died. And it left me in the position of realizing how awful a thing this is, of having to make a decision about whether you're going to now help someone who had become now a friend as well as someone who I'd worked with, and was watching that she would possibly wake up with further brain damage rather than have achieved the goal she wanted, which was a peaceful death.
So what did you do?
Well, I have to say that I can't be completely open about what I did. What is clear is that what was wrong with this situation was that I was there alone, that there was no counselor that was available to me or to Renee, that there was no professional help, no one with real experience in death and dying issues, that this process of the secrecy that because of the illegality of anyone helping in a suicide at the end of life, that I, like thousands of other members of families, it was the first time I really realized the significance of the isolation and the pain that's brought onto families to have to make these decisions themselves. Final Exit recommends that in a situation like this, you use a plastic bag and simply slip it over the person's head and they die from lack of oxygen while they're unconscious. I had to make the decision about whether to do that or not. But the point to me is really not what I decided to do. The point is that I alone was making that decision without adequate instructions from Renee, without adequate help or counseling from people who had more experience. And this is a procedure that should not be done in hiding and shouldn't be made at 6 o'clock in the morning by a man in tears as I was, trying to figure out what should I do, what would my friend want, and what's appropriate here. It should be something that's open as a part of the medical community.
My guest is Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, author of the new book, A Chosen Death, The Dying Confront Assisted Suicide. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Lonnie Shavelson is my guest. He's an emergency room physician in Berkeley, California, and the author of the new book, A Chosen Death, The Dying Confront Assisted Suicide. Now, you know, you've said that what people are doing now is turning to friends and loved ones and asking them to help them in their suicide. But there's another group of people who you can turn to, the people who you describe as the freelance euthanasia people.
Yes.
And you have a chapter devoted to that in your new book. Is this a big new occupation, freelance euthanasia?
You know, because of the fact that it's so secret, and I think this is the problem again, is the secrecy. No one knows how big an occupation. I have to say, to me, this is the most appalling part of what I discovered. There are people out there who really believe in the right to die. The right to die meaning the right that somebody should be able to make, in this case, a decision at the end of their life to end their life by an overdose. Frequently, that person is unable to do it by themselves, and there are a lot of people who believe in this so strongly that, like Jack Kevorkian, they're willing to assist in their deaths. Unfortunately, many of these people have very little experience. Most of the time what happened was that, like what happened with Renee and I, is that they experienced a death of a loved one, they helped, and they found that it was the right thing to do, and then they decide to go out and help other people. I personally witnessed one person who helped someone who had had a stroke who really wasn't that sick, as she literally assisted in his suicide. And the question of whether she actually killed him came up because he was not able to really do much on his own part because of his paralysis. There are people out there with no experience whatsoever who you never see in the headlines as you do Jack Kevorkian, who, because of the fact that patients can't get help from their physicians, they literally have found freelance euthanasists who are willing to come over plastic bag in hand and help them die. And I think this is a tremendous tragedy. I can't tell you how often it's happening. I can tell you that I've heard myself of dozens of stories of this happening.
Now, do you think it's tragic because the freelance euthanasists don't really know what they're doing? Or do you think it's tragic that people should have to turn to freelance euthanasists because you can't turn to the medical profession?
Both are. I think, in essence, the real tragedy is this, is that many, many people who are saying, I'm done, I've had enough, I want to die, are really just asking for help in living better. What they're saying is, I'm having too much pain, or I'm suffering too much, or I'm bedridden and have bed sores, or I can't control my bowels. And what they should be doing is turning to people who are experienced in death and dying, hospice nurses and hospice physicians and good care providers and family members. And so I think that to turn to the fact that people are so desperate that they're turning to these inexperienced people is a tragedy because they're, number one, not getting good medical care before they die. It's not a good death to be dying under the hands of a freelance euthanasist. And these people are also inexperienced in even doing the procedure of bringing on a death. The best tool they have is frequently some over-the-counter sleeping pills in a plastic bag. That's not a dignified death, and that's what people are wanting, is a dignified death.
This reminds me of another point you raise in your book, which is that sometimes somebody will really think they're ready to die, but really what they are is very depressed and very uncomfortable, and that might change tomorrow. Tomorrow
Absolutely.
They might be less depressed, they might be less uncomfortable. For instance, one of the people you write about, Pierre Nadeau, asked a friend to help him commit suicide, and the friend turned him down. And then Pierre, who had AIDS, started feeling better a little bit after that and regained the desire to live.
You know, Pierre is a very good example of a lot of what I saw in this book, is that this book is as much about how people go on and have intense desires to live as it is about how they decide to die. Pierre Nadeau was an acrobat in a circus and had a beautiful, wonderful body. He was a gay man who also developed AIDS. And as soon as his body showed any sign of deterioration, Pierre became tremendously depressed. And with his first hospitalization for a minor infection, he actually got in touch with me and said, I want you to document my death. I'm going to kill myself. I'm ready to die. Fortunately, a large support group gathered around him, and he asked specifically. He had an intravenous line at the time. He told them, kill me now. I'm ready to go. And everyone said, no, you're not ready to go. You've got months to live. And I think in this case, a good judgment was made. What happened was Pierre's daughter, who was 6 years old at the time, Alexa, her birthday was about a week later, and he agreed to live for another week. And then after Alexa's visit, something else happened that he decided he wanted to live for, a final motorcycle ride around the city, or another trip to the circus, or another party of a friend. And this went on for 8 months, where Pierre kept on putting off his death and putting off his death until he finally stopped speaking about it at all. And went under good hospice care, had a comfortable natural death. And I think that the lesson of this, of course, is that it's a very, very complex question. When somebody says, I've had enough and I want to die, it really does take careful thought on the person's part and on advice the person's given and on the medical system's part to decide whether this is appropriate or not and to work with them on the issue of why are you asking that question. Unfortunately, what I see now is that many people are asking that question and saying or making the statement, I'm ready to die. And because there isn't experienced care and advice available because of the illegality in responding to this question, some people are saying, okay, we'll help you, and doing it. And it's a tremendous catastrophe when we lose. Pierre lived on for another 8 months after his initial request.
Do you think that because he lived long after his initial request, he was actually more prepared to die when he died?
Without a doubt. Oh, I think without a doubt. Not only was Pierre more prepared to die, his daughter Alexa was not given the feeling that her father had just suddenly abandoned her by the suicide. I think that his entire family, his entire support group, everyone was more ready, including Pierre. And Pierre was sort of watching his renaissance, watching him recover from the depression and go on with life and enjoy it as much as he possibly could until the moment when he was finally ready to say, enough, and he actually became unconscious at that point in time and passed away on his own.
What kind of system do you think would work?
I think the system that would work is that every time someone says, "I'm ready to die, help me," is that we understand that as a plea for help first, and that we offer the best help, whether it's a 12-year-old child with leukemia or a 90-year-old man with Alzheimer's disease, that some system is set up so that it is understood that under the best of care, some people suffer too much at death. We have a tremendous amount of technology involved right now in keeping people alive. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And if we could divert some of the medical ethics technology and some of the physical technology into making sure that when somebody makes this plea for assistance in death, that the first thing they're given is assistance in being comfortable in life, and maybe they can live on those next 24 to 48 hours, that might be a very meaningful experience for them. On the other hand, for the rare few, and I really think it's a rare few, but there will be those few, and they will always exist, who are suffering greatly, who have nothing to gain by those last 24 to 48 hours. I hope then that the system will include, after they've been offered every chance to be helped in other ways, a lethal injection that would help them to die. I think it's a technological procedure and a medical procedure that can be done under the best of circumstances with ethics committees reviewing the procedure beforehand with permission from people who have experience in death and dying, who have evaluated each case, and then to finally say, look, we've done all we can for this patient. If the patient requests it and wants to, this is the time when we can help them die, and I hope that that can happen.
As a son, you wouldn't want the responsibility of assisting in one of your parents' suicide. As a doctor, would you want the responsibility of administering a lethal injection?
As a doctor, I have to say that I have the responsibility of dealing with death and dying. And one of the things that I hear from many physicians is that they feel that doctors are healers and we should be involved only in healing. Well, you know, I really must emphasize the fact that I think those doctors are mistaken. Physicians are involved in healing, and they're involved in the death process. People do die, and when someone goes to medical school, if they think they're just going to be healers and not deal with death, I think they need to turn around and walk out the door. Death is a very real thing. I think that as a doctor, if it turns out that the best thing for a patient, the only thing I can offer them is pain control to the point where they're going to be, where the only way that I can offer help is to assist in their own death at their request, then I'm willing to do that.
I think for a lot of people, it's Jack Kevorkian who represents assisted suicide. Is he a good ambassador?
Well, yes and no. I think Jack Kevorkian has indeed brought this out of secrecy and out of hiding, finally. This process has been going on, and one of the things I write about is that my grandmother received an assisted suicide by her physician in secrecy, back when 2 years before I was born, and I'm 43 now. Obviously this has been going on for years, if not hundreds of years. And what Jack Kevorkian has done is finally brought it out of hiding, and I think that's good. I think that society needs to deal with issues up front and not deal with them while hiding in darkened bedrooms. On the other hand, I think that Jack Kevorkian is a bad ambassador because he doesn't have the experience in providing comfort care and providing hospice-type care and really evaluating a patient to make sure that that's the right person. And he's not consulting with other physicians, with ethicists. There's no system set up around him that makes it good. So I think that Jack Kevorkian is an example of, if we continue to keep this illegal, we are creating Jack Kevorkians. We are creating freelance euthanasists, and we're creating family members who have to make the decision. Neither of those is none of that is a good system. So Jack Kevorkian has done a great service, I think, in bringing this to the point where the public is really discussing it. And then I think you should fade into the background and let us find a better way.
Lonnie Shavelson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Dr. Lonnie Shavelson is the author of A Chosen Death. He's an emergency room physician who lives in Berkeley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the punishments and rewards of a working man's life. We talk with Reg Theriault. He was a longshoreman for over 30 years. He's written a new book about work called How to Tell When You're Tired. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward revives the sound of an obscure rhythm and blues singer, Mabel John. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What does it mean to work all your life at hard physical labor? Reg Theriault gives his answers to that question in his new book, How to Tell When You're Tired. He spent over 30 years as a longshoreman on the San Francisco waterfront. He was also the vice president of his union's local. He grew up in a family of migrant farm workers, fruit tramps, as they called themselves. At his mother's urging, he graduated high school and went on to college, but he dropped out. He says he didn't think he'd get the teaching job he wanted, and he missed the camaraderie of the fields. So he returned to fruit tramping. After his children were born in the late 50s, he found work on the waterfront. He says he worked hard as a longshoreman, but he liked the life.
When I started, we worked in gangs, so you worked with other people with whom you got along, and other people who help you, and you help them. It has a kind of camaraderie, and it has a lot of drudgery. But when you get through, you walk off the ship and see it sail. I don't know. You go back to the hiring hall the next day and get another job, and it's a different ship entirely. You start all over again. Usually you work with the same guys. If you don't like it, you find some other guys you work with. The bosses, as long as you do your work, they leave you alone. Or they better leave you alone. And it has a long, honorable tradition. I've never felt that I wasn't the equal of anyone else. And there in San Francisco, anyway, there are no circles to which I've been denied entry.
What was a typical day for you like in the early years when you were working on the waterfront?
We had to be at the hiring hall to get our job at 6:30 in the morning, so that meant that you got up and, you know, 5:30. Got your job in the hiring hall, and then you got a ticket to report to a peer, and it could be either anywhere in the Bay Area. San Francisco Bay Area longshoremen work all over the Bay Area. There's only one group of longshoremen in the Bay Area, and that's us. And then you report to the pier, see guys you know, have a cup of coffee, find out what cargo you got, and curse your luck if it's barbed wire. Or in those days, in the old days, we used to do everything by hand. Coffee, 154 pounds, sacks, and go to work, pitch in. And you worked hard. Frequently, we would have cargo or the breaks in the day where it only took, if we had eight men on a loading gang, we may only use four or six. So the others four would work very hard, and you'd go sit down. And when they got tired, well, you'd get up and hit it heavy, and they'd sit down.
What's the best way to carry a 154-pound sack of coffee?
Well, you don't carry it, and you don't lift it alone. You have a man on the other end of the sack, so you pitch it. In those days, we sent it out on rope slings, and it was considerably easier than later when we had to load them on pallet boards inside the vessel down in the hold. That was really, I would say, of all the jobs I've ever had, that was the hardest job.
Why?
Palletizing coffee in the hold of a vessel.
What was especially hard about that?
You had to sort the coffee and find the sacks, wherever they were, and drag them back to the board. And then they also didn't just stop at 12. We used to put as many as 18 or 24 sacks on the board. You had to throw them up over your head sometimes, you actually did. And it went on, and there were no breaks. No breaks, no, unless the gear broke down, you never got a break on palletized coffee.
But you got breaks on other jobs.
Well, we always had a break midday. I mean, we had a, in our contract, we got a 15-minute break in the middle of the morning, middle of the afternoon. But at the other jobs, we used to make our breaks. We would just bust our butt and then sit down. We'd work it with each other. It was actually more fun and easier to work hard at something you're doing and take breaks. We felt so, and longshoremen all over the world work this way. I know, I've talked to a lot of seamen. And that was our mode of working, you know. And I, frankly, enjoyed the hard work, even sometimes as fun. You physically, if it's not destructive, meaning you're not tearing up your back, hard work's okay.
So what changed that rhythm of working really hard and then taking a break? Was it the union that negotiated a 15-hour break?
The 15-minute break, yes.
I'm sorry, did I say 15-hour?
Yeah.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, yes. Yes, and automation came along, and the union negotiated. The companies were adamant. They didn't want to have 8 men in a gang working in the hold if all you were doing were landing vans. And we lost men, and we lost more men. Finally, it got to the point where you were down to, sometimes we theoretically never had fewer than 4 men, but you may be scattered all over the vessel. And then they did away with gangs, and you ended up working on whatever isolated job you might have. I think automation cut in more than anything. When I first went to work on the waterfront in 1959, the San Francisco Bay Area used 5,000 longshoremen. Right now, there's about 800 working. So it cut. And their tonnage has gone up, I think, 600% since then. So there are one-fifth as many men and women now. We have women longshoremen. Some of them are very good. And I say one-fifth, one-sixth as many longshoremen doing 6 times the work.
My guest is former longshoreman Reg Theriault, author of How to Tell When You're Tired, A Brief Examination of Work. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former longshoreman Reg Theriault. When you were working on the waterfront, did you have a lot of back trouble? Shoulder strain?
Yes, I think every longshoreman. I'm retired now on disability. I was injured tying up a vessel.
What happened?
Well, I was tying up a large container ship. And the way it's done is they feed the... And they don't even use rope. They use wire cable. And they feed it off of the ship. And we have what we call a messenger, which is a light manila line. And you pull on the messenger until you get the wire. And the wire has a loop around it, and we put it over a bollard on dock. Well, the wire is so heavy that we had to tow it with a forklift truck. And the forklift driver was towing it up out of the water and then through the two horns, these great big bollards have horns that you put the loop of wire around. He went through the bollard and then for some reason or other, the vessel, the dry winch driver on the playing out the wire on the vessel stopped and then backed it up and it tightened that wire just like I said violin string, but it's a little over an inch wire. And as it became tight, it jumped the bollard. And I had just reached for the loop. And the wire caught me across the hips, picked me up, and threw me back about 10 feet. Hmm. And that ended my longshore career.
Now, what was your reaction when you're hurt? I mean, did you know what was happening to you? And were you expecting at some point that something like this was going to be inevitable?
No, you don't expect to be hurt. And when it does come, it comes as a surprise. I discovered that I'd been hurt only 15 times on the waterfront. 15 times requiring medical attention. Mm-hmm. There were some longshoremen that had 60 or 70 injuries over their life, their career.
That's a lot of injuries.
I know it is. That there are other occupations equally as dangerous. Mining has always had, I think, a higher accident rate than longshoring. You don't. I picked myself up, discovered I could stand and that I could walk. I didn't know. I knew I was hurt. I didn't know how bad. I found out later that I did had chipped a bone in my hip, and finally it was grinding bone on bone, so they had to replace my hip.
And that's why you couldn't go back to work.
Well, I also had my left knee restructured, and I have four herniated discs in my lower back. So they all compounded to feed off each other, and I just simply couldn't know.
Were those previous injuries or part of the same problem?
Yeah, part of it. But all of them are longshore connected.
But those were from previous accidents?
Yes. I went back to work tying up ships, and I couldn't do it. And the guys were trying to carry me. And they can't do it because sometimes it is very hard. Sometimes the vessels use nylon, 6-inch in diameter. And they're heavier nails, so you need everybody. You can't carry a guy. And I didn't want to. And so I took disability retirement.
How did container ships change the nature of your work? And you should explain what they are, too.
Well, where before we'd broke down the cargo in the hold, stacked it up in tiers. The containers were loaded either off the dock or on the dock, and the entire container was loaded aboard the ship. For instance, right now, you can vessels are loaded in wherever around the world with a crane driver, a hatch tender, 5 tractor drivers, and a clerk. What does that come to? About 8 or 9 people. And they'll do more work in 8 hours than 8 gangs would previously. So it changed the work. The automation did away with an awful lot of longshore work. Those vans are loaded just like ships used to be, somewhere off in the middle of wherever they are, you know, they're discharged. What it meant to us is that we were fragmented. Most of our workday is spent alone doing a job, isolated from someone else. In that sense, we lost a great deal of the glue that kept us together.
Your book is primarily about blue-collar work. Did you ever in your working career wish that you had a white-collar job and that you didn't have to lift things every day, that your body wasn't straining every day when you went to work?
I suppose that more than wishing for a white-collar job, that I was wishing for another job, blue-collar job that was easier. From the day I quit Cal and returned to fruit tramping, I had no regrets, and I still haven't. I never had any regrets about rechoosing blue-collar, hard physical work. And that may sound eccentric, but an awful lot of people doing, a lot of longshoremen I know, would have it no other way, even though they might not admit it. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty, they're working. If they're working people, they're doing what they want to do. If they're making a good money, if you're scrounging, if you're really hustling and you're not making a living, that's when it's mean. But if you have a good job and you're blue-collar, hey, what more do you want?
Reg Theriault is the author of How to Tell When You're Tired, A Brief Examination of Work.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams in Washington with a word about what's coming up on NPR's All Things Considered. Michael Scholar reports from Goma, Zaire, on the expulsion of Rwandan refugees from Zaire, and that more than 8,000 refugees have fled the camps there to keep from being sent back to Rwanda. Lorna Jordan reports on a conflict over radioactive waste at a former nuclear weapons plant in Ohio. Cancer researchers want access to this waste because the radium could be used in experimental therapies. Schoolhouse Rock, educational features on television on Saturday morning for many years, is now an off-Broadway musical. Also, storyteller Bill Harley has a summer night story for us involving the dark and camping in the backyard. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Many of America's forgotten soul and rhythm and blues musicians have been rediscovered by the British. One of the performers we can thank them for rediscovering is 60s soul singer Mabel John. Rock historian Ed Ward has this retrospective of Mabel John's career.
Recognize the name Mabel John, it's as the sister of the legendary and tragic singer Little Willie John, which is a shame. As a songwriter and a performer, she's recorded a body of work that deserves to be better known, yet her one masterpiece is also pretty obscure. She was born in 1930, the eldest of the John children, and raised in Detroit, where, with her four next-in-line siblings, she became famous in the neighborhood for impromptu gospel shows in the kitchen, with her mother playing guitar and her father beating on cake pans. Neighbors would gather in the yard and listen. Willie went into show business first, while Mabel went to work at an insurance company where she worked with Berry Gordy's mother. Gordy was already writing songs and looking for a way into the business, so when Mabel was encouraged to join her brother's show as an opening act in 1956, he became her manager and mentor, and when he started Motown, Mabel became the first woman signed to its Tamla subsidiary. She recorded four songs for Tamla, but none of them hit, and in 1963 she asked to be released. 3 years later, she was signed to Stax in Memphis, where they made more down-home records than Motown did. In May 1966, they released a record that she never surpassed.
I don't have to beg you to hold me, 'cause somebody else will. Is about to come to an end. No real good thing is about to come to an end.
Your Good Thing is About to Come to an End hit the top 10 on black radio, but maybe its dark, brooding menace frightened off pop radio. It only reached 95 on the pop charts. She followed it up with two flops. You're Taking Up Another Man's Place was a sound alike, and Same Time, Same Place was musically undistinguished. I'm a Big Girl Now came out a year later, but it too failed to do anything, and then she released a record that even today is absolutely shocking. It's hard to imagine any radio programmer keeping it on after its first few words.
I'm so sorry you had to slap me, 'cause you've never done that before. But I'm so glad
Even in the relative innocence of 1967, that was too much. In interviews with the British researcher Rob Bowman, Mabel has said that, "I've never recorded anything that was not part of my own life," although she also wrote with a younger friend, Stack's head of promotion Deanie Catron Parker, who found it therapeutic working out her marital problems in rhyme with her friend Mabel. Although Stax recorded her a lot, most of the material remained unreleased until 1993, when Fantasy Records assembled a collection of it, her first album ever. Her last session for Stax came shortly after her brother Willie died in prison in 1968 and included a version of his 1956 hit, "I Need Your Love So Bad."
I need someone's hand to lead me through the night. I need someone's arm to hold.
Ironically, she recorded it to make sure the world wouldn't forget him, although, despite a stint afterwards as one of Ray Charles's Raylettes, it was Mabel, not Willie, who's been all but forgotten.
Ed Ward writes about music and is based in Berlin. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock and Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You ought to know. Now you say we run your life and tell you what to do. Deep down we love you, but we can't take much from you. All women are alike. They've got to have their way. So don't you know we give you everything and we expect the same. So if you can't stand the heat, stay out the kitchen. Stay out the kitchen. You feel it tied down and won't let you breathe. You should spend your time on us with the ones you've got.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia and from Rhino Records, presenting the new album Till the Night Is Gone, a collection of Doc Pomus classics by Sean Colvin, Bob Dylan, and others. This is NPR, National Public Radio.